Singing can be a profoundly moving thing, especially, I believe, in the midst of suffering. Joining together with others in song can remind us in a really powerful way that we're not alone, in a way that I wonder if no other human activity can. And singing familiar songs, especially songs that we've sung and sung again throughout the course of our lifetimes or at particular times in our lives, can function as a deeply meaningful and often emotional reminder of that spiritual bedrock that we've stood on all those years. I also believe that in times of suffering, times of hardship, music and singing can function as a kind of spiritual bridge for us, a kind of bridge. It can be a way of holding both the present moment and God's promised future together all at once. Worshiping through song in times of suffering can be a way of looking forward to and moving forward into that future. And it can also be a way of participating and working and bringing about that future now. Singing can be a profoundly moving thing, especially in the midst of suffering. A couple years back, the BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, aired a program called The Songs of the Civil Rights Movement. It opens with this recording of a man who is being interviewed, someone who is directly and extensively involved in the movement. And this is what he says. Without music, the civil rights movement would have been like a bird without wings, because music created a sense of solidarity. It unified people. It inspired us to go out and to sit in. So someone would come up to you, he says, well, you were sitting at a segregated lunch counter in Nashville, in Atlanta, in Birmingham, in Montgomery, and they would pour hot water on you or hot coffee or put a lit cigarette down your back. And you would just sit there and maybe start to hum a song. You would get arrested in a mass arrest and you'd start singing. In this recording, another woman's voice comes through as we listen. She describes time that she spent in jail having participated in direct action. At night, the sheriff would come and say, stop singing. And if we didn't stop, which we didn't, she says, if it was hot, he would turn up the heat. And if it was cool, he would turn up the air conditioning. And so to keep our morale up, we sang. We could hear the men singing in their part of the jail, and they would sing to us, and we would sing back to them. Over my head, I hear music in the air. That was one of my favorites, she tells the interviewer. Over my head. I just heard that song, just sang that song together a few minutes ago. Over my head, I hear music in the air. Oh, I really do believe there must be a heaven somewhere. There must be a God somewhere. Singing can be a profoundly moving thing, especially in the midst of suffering. It can be a kind of bridge for us. A kind of bridge between one jail cell and another, a bridge between a night in a jail cell and a life in heaven somewhere, as the song goes. It can be part of a bridge that's being built in our world, in this world, to make way and to make our way from here to there. This morning we're continuing our series that we're calling Worthy, in which we're exploring this book of Revelation. And our hope, as we've shared, is that we'd be able to learn or maybe relearn something about what it means to be worshiping and especially singing creatures as people of God. When we touched on that series a couple weeks ago, we looked at chapter 5. And this week we'll be skipping past chapter 6, as you'll have noticed, and focusing in on chapter 7. We're making that jump not because chapter 6 isn't important or doesn't have things to say, but because for this series we're just looking specifically at the songs that appear in this book, in these texts. And this is where we find the next set of them. In this chapter, chapter 7, John continues to describe this heavenly vision that God gave to him while he was in exile on the island of Patmos. And as we look at it, we'll be focusing in on some of the ways that worship and music and song can function in the midst of suffering and injustice, reflecting on the ways that singing and worshiping and song might sometimes be a kind of bridge for people. We'll look at what that might have meant, how that might have been the case for the early Christians who would have first read and heard this collection of writings, and we'll look at what that might mean for us in our world today. As we come to this text, as we hear it read this morning, we're quickly reminded again that what John sees here when he's receiving this vision is complex. It's this multi-layered mix of symbolism and meaning and imagery and theology. It's written in a way, a genre that we aren't typically familiar with. So for a lot of people, it can be really confusing, maybe even frightening to read. As we've said before, the book of Revelation deserves a lot more attention than we're able to give it in this short series. We're going to look at it just from one particular angle as we continue to go along. One layer of it. And that's what it shows us about what it means to be worshiping and music making and singing people. Here in chapter 7, John tells his readers that in this vision, he sees four angels, each standing at the four corners of the earth. They're holding back, he says, the four winds of the earth. Again, this is apocalyptic language and symbolic imagery, which doesn't mean that it's any less true. It simply means that all the imagery that John is seeing and writing about here is representative of the truth and the reality of what God has brought about and what God will bring about in history. Into this scene, we're told that John sees another angel, a fifth angel appear, holding the seal of the living God. If any of you have been reading along or read through Revelation in preparation for this series, you'll be aware that the description of seals, wax seals, is something that appears throughout this book. It's a symbol that's used here in a number of different ways. At times, they represent this gradual revelation, this gradual unveiling that John receives. It's this image of seals being broken one after another as this large scroll is being unrolled for someone. Other times we see seals used to symbolize or represent a sense of guarantee or protection or ownership, which is the sense that John is likely using, likely had in mind when he penned these verses here. John, we read, describes all those who had been sealed in this way. There are 144,000 of them, 12 groups of 12,000 from 12 tribes, a number and accounts that symbolizes completeness. Each of them, he says, is given a seal, God's seal, which is to say that they belong to God. They're protected and kept and identified and enclosed within God. It's this incredibly comforting and assuring picture for readers to consider. And after this, John tells his readers that he sees an even greater crowd, an even bigger number, this immense mass of people that he has no count for, no number for. So many people are there, he tells us, that no one can count them. People from every place, every continent and country, all standing before the throne of God. And then John writes, this uncountable multitude breaks out in worship. They begin to sing. Salvation belongs to our God who sits upon the throne and to the Lamb. Praise and glory and wisdom and thanks and honor and power and strength be to our God. After this, while the words still seem to be echoing, it would seem someone speaks to John, an elder, we're told. And this elder asks John who all these people are. John responds enigmatically, kind of mysteriously. You know, he says. And so the elder tells him, these are those who have come through the great tribulation. They have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. Okay. Again, in case you haven't caught it, the book of Revelation is complex, confusing to make sense of, to say the least. You can try to pick it apart and analyze every piece and part of it if you'd like. Lots of people have, especially when it comes to trying to make sense of what it might mean for the future, for times to come. That's maybe part of the meaning, part of the work, but it's just as important, I believe, to recognize that as a collection of writings, it was meant for those living in the present and those who continue to live in the present today. It was first written to and read, of course, by early Christians, by Christians living in the time that John lived. And we know something about those people, about that ancient church. We know something about what they were experiencing when John received and relayed all this to them. We know that those early Christians living in the first and second centuries were living on the underside of the Roman Empire. Most scholars, most historians believe that they would have been experiencing either local or widespread persecution, or sometimes both. We know that there is this enormous pressure to bow to the emperor, to participate in emperor worship, and often severe and violent penalties for those who didn't. a great tribulation. So we can maybe begin to see how the songs that we read about here in these chapters in Revelation, songs that very well may have been sung aloud by those earliest Christians, might have functions in the midst of their experiences of suffering. We can maybe begin to see how those songs might have served as a kind of bridge for them, a bridge between their present moments with all of its anguish and adversity and the reality of John's heavenly vision, in which all of God's holy people are joined together in song, worshiping and worshiping and never running out of breath. We can begin to see how these worshipful words set to song as we read them here could have served as a kind of bridge. That's part of the journey and part of the work between that place that those early Christians found themselves in and the eternal place that John saw and sang about. Over my head, I hear music in the air. Oh, I really do believe there must be a heaven somewhere. The songs that were sung during the course of the civil rights movements, you may know, came to be known as freedom songs. These songs, many of them Christian spirituals and hymns, function in a number of really unique and powerful ways during that time. Many of them expressed sorrow and laments about the realities of suffering and sorrow that the African-American people were experiencing at that time, realities of segregation and race-based violence. They were a profound source of comfort during a profoundly traumatic and trouble-filled time. Other times we know these songs served as a way of protesting or uniting or even communicating sometimes. They're often sung with hopes of inspiring people to stand firm in the face of brutality and rallying people to demonstration and action in the face of injustice. We might think of what's come to be maybe the most familiar of all the freedom songs, a hymn sung at marches and recited by Martin Luther King Jr. in his final sermon before he was assassinated. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall overcome someday. In that BBC radio interview I listened to, they talk about the background of that song and how it was sung, which is all interesting. But what I want to know is if you can hear it, if you can see it. It's a bridge of courage and hope between the now and the not yet, between the present and the promise. We shall overcome someday. Something much deeper, I believe, than escapism. Something different than hiding out and huddling together and humming along. We're hoping to be whisked off to heaven. A few weeks ago, I was reading about members of this little church in Germany during the Second World War. Their church building was stood right in front of a set of train tracks, railway tracks. And each Sunday, the members of this congregation would gather, and they would hear the trains roll past with cattle cars full of Jews headed off to the death camps. And when the trains came past, they would sing. They would sing hymns as loudly as they could to try to drown out the noise. The noise of the wheels on the tracks and the noise of the voices that cried out. And the man that was recalling this all in this book was tormented by this memory. He was tormented by the fact that they did nothing but sing. So it's different, I believe, than a kind of escapism, which we know can be an easy thing to do. Gathering around in worshipful song as a way of distracting ourselves from our own suffering or drowning out the sound of the suffering of our worlds. No, it's a kind of bridge. A bridge of action and hope that's being built to bring about the reality of God's justice and love on earth as it is in heaven. We shall overcome someday. So I wonder again if there's something similar to these kinds of singing. Yes, the realities are different, the times are different, the issues and the powers and the forms of oppression and violence are different. But is there something about the way that singing functioned during the years of the civil rights movement that can help us understand how these songs in these chapters and verses functioned for those early Christians living with their own hurts and hardship? And is there something in that that might be helpful for us here today as we try to understand why and how we worship as followers of Jesus? Really, I know I don't have to ask you. I know, I've heard the stories how there have been times in your lives when singing, when worship has been a kind of bridge for you. Times when worship has been a bridge that's connected you deeply to others. A bridge that you felt has connected you in some way to God's. A bridge between the pain and the hurts of the world, the pain and the hurt of your world, and God's world without ends. Our daughter, Jubilee, has always been a musical child. Maybe this is normal, but she sang before she was able to speak. And so for us as parents, if she's ever upset or hurt or fussy or frustrated, we've often said to her, "Do you want to sing a song?" And more often than not, it's this little whimpered yes that we hear in reply. And singing away we go. And more often than not, she calms down. Over these past few weeks, in and out of the hospital, she did some singing. And I know it was a distraction tactic in part, but for us as parents and for Meg there with her, it was also mixed with this ache-filled longing together, trying to hold together that present moment, the pain of that, and that desire to move to the future in which she was well again. I was listening to the radio in my car a while back and caught part of another interview that was being aired. The CBC this time, not the BBC. And I wish I had a pen with me to jot the details down. I can't remember them all, but the person being interviewed was describing this experience of living through a natural disaster. I can't remember if it was an earthquake or a tsunami or something else. But in any case, he was talking about the horrible devastation at that time and sharing that at one point while he was standing there in the midst of this, he saw a group of people gather together and begin to sing together, begin to worship together. They began singing, "I love you, Lord," a song that we've often sung here. "I love you, Lord, and I lift my voice to worship you. Oh, my soul, rejoice. Take joy, my King, in what you hear. Let it be a sweet, sweet sound in your ear." Which seems like such an unlikely response in the midst of a disaster situation, right? Seems like such a stark contrast and juxtaposition. Until you realize that their singing, their worshiping was a kind of bridge for them in that moment. They weren't plugging their ears like the members of that little German church. They weren't pretending that nothing had happened. They weren't camped out in the sanctuary while everyone else was hurting and in need of help. They were weeping and working and pulling one another out of the rubble, and they were worshiping all the while they went. The interviewee didn't say it, of course, but we can hear it and we can see it. Their singing, their worshiping was functioning like a kind of bridge. It was a bridge between one another, a bridge to meet each other on in that moment, a space for a sense of connection between them and God's in a time when they needed God's deeply. It was a bridge in which the pain of their present moments and their hope could be joined together somehow, held together somehow. It was a bridge for them to travel across, to bring about some measure of healing to their situation, their hearts, and their worlds. When we think about the book and the context of Revelation, it can maybe strike us as just as unlikely a juxtaposition, just as stark a contrast. Because here we have these early Christians, right? People who first heard and read these words, who were pressured and persecuted and suffering and dying under an empire that demanded their full allegiance and worship. And then we have these glimpses, these words of a beautiful and painless and perfect vision of believers in spotless clothes, circled together and singing in God's presence. Could there be two more different scenes? Could you have two more different things to try to hold together at once? How do you hold together the suffering at the sit-in, the nights in the jail cell, the days in the hospital beds, the moments after the natural disaster, and songs of worship? It doesn't make sense. So you start to see that this is part of what we do when we worship. This is part of what worship does in us and for us and in the world and for the worlds. In worshiping, we make and are given bridges. While recognizing Again, that these are different experiences, and without claiming or appropriating these experiences for ourselves, I think most of us can say that worship and song has functioned in something of this way for us at one time or another in our lives. There have been times when worshiping through song has been a kind of bridge for us. Not in a magical or mechanical way, I don't believe, but often in a profoundly meaningful way, and sometimes, I believe, a mystical way. I think that most of us would say that there are times when singing and worship has provided a deep sense of company and communion, a sense of not being alone in the world, not being alone in our experiences. There are times when singing and worship has provided deep courage and resolve as we wake up to and work in a world full of pain and injustice. There are times when singing and worship has reminded us of important things and provided hope and joy of God's eternal kingdom that will continue to come in the world until it finally comes in fullness. Again, I know I don't have to ask you. I know that this has been the case for so many of you at so many times, that there have been times when worship, when singing has been a kind of bridge for you. Coming back to John's vision and John's question as we find it here in chapter 7. John's told that the multitudes that are there are those who had undergone and come through that great suffering. And the elder continues telling John that they have washed their robes and made them white in the blood of the Lamb. And that therefore they are before the throne of God and serve him day and night in his temple. And he who sits on the throne will shelter them with his presence. Never again will they hunger, he writes. Never again will they thirst. The sun will not beat down on them, nor any scorching heat. For the Lamb at the center of the throne will be their shepherds. He will lead them to springs of water, and God will wipe every tear from their eyes. I don't know about you, but the book of Revelation used to terrify me, and was, if my memory serves me correctly, on more than one occasion also used to terrify me. And I recognize that's maybe part of its purpose, to disturb the comfortable, to provoke, to challenge, to warn, to call people to be awake and alert in the world. But as I've read through it again and again, I've come to see that as much as that may be true, and maybe even more than that, it's a collection of writing that's intended to comfort the disturbed. It's meant to give hope and comfort and assurance to those who are suffering and sorrowing in the present moments. Never again will they hunger or thirst. God will wipe away every tear from their eyes. In the BBC program about those years of the civil rights movement, the hosts and interviewees talked about how singing like this, singing worship songs, took place in all kinds of different settings. Hymns, spirituals, and gospel songs permeated the whole movement, they say. Everywhere people went, there was singing. At marches, at meetings, at demonstrations, at rallies, at church services, in jail, at sit-ins while people were being beaten, at funerals, in homes, on the streets, at concerts. Again and again, singing was, as the host describes it, a source of healing, spiritual sustenance, joyful release, and protest. Worship and singing permeated the whole thing. Everywhere you looked, you saw it and you heard it. It was in every corner of their worlds and their existence. Imagine that it was something like that for those earliest Christians, those ancient Christians living in the early days of the church, singing and working as they went. And such might be the invitation for us as well today, to sing songs to God as we go, wherever we go, while we work and work for justice in the world, when we're wronged and when we're mourning and when we're celebrating, whenever. And all the while building bridges as we go. Amen. In place of a spoken benediction this morning, we'll share a sung benediction. Blessings reflect for us a desire that's directed to God and to each other. And would invite you as we hear this song and sing this song together to sing accordingly. The choir will lead us through it one time, and then we'll sing through twice following that. After that, we'll let you depart into your day. In reminder that we have our meeting this afternoon. I would invite you to please stand now if you're able.